This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. President Joe Biden's recent nomination of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to the U.S. Supreme Court is unprecedented. There has never before been a black woman nominated to the nation's highest court, a court that is the final arbiter of how the Constitution, Bill of Rights, and the laws of the nation are applied. Yet Biden's nomination is likely to make little difference in the larger balance of power on the court, given that the opinions of the six conservative justices will still overwhelm the decisions of the three more liberal ones. In his newly released first book, Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution, legal scholar Elie Mystal argues that the founders wrote the original Constitution narrowly and with such haste that they were forced to add on the Bill of Rights to remedy its gaping holes. Elie Mystal is justice correspondent for The Nation, where he covers the courts, the criminal justice system, and politics. He writes the magazine's monthly column, Objection. He's also an Alfred Nobler Fellow at the Type Media Center and a graduate of Harvard College and Harvard Law School. I spoke with Mystal about his book, Allow Me to Retort, for Yes Magazine, where I work as the racial justice editor. You can read a transcript and watch the video of the full interview at yesmagazine.org. Today, we'll play you an excerpt of that conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Why did you decide to take on the U.S. Constitution, or as you clarify in your book, really the Bill of Rights?
The main reason I decided to look at it this way is we have been told a lot by conservative white people, what the Constitution means, what the law means, how it should be interpreted, and why. And that perspective is, from my perspective, just one option among many. And the other option involve looking at the Constitution as a flawed document that needs to be perfected in order to achieve some level of fundamental fairness and equality, a level of fundamental fairness and equality that was, shall we say, missing from the initial kind of first draft of it, written by slavers, colonists, and people willing to make deals with slavers and colonists. So I bring a perspective to the Constitution that is informed by the fact that the Constitution used to think that I wasn't a person. Right. And from that starting point, I kind of look at that document a little bit differently. It's not a secret text to me. It's a flawed piece of political philosophy. And I look at it from that perspective. And I think that perspective is valuable just as the moment as the conservatives are ascendant. And their view and their ideology of the Constitution is ascendant, I think it's good to have a counter argument for what they're trying to do.
You point out that even though the Constitution, Bill of Rights, etc., are flawed documents, they do contain pretty decent arguments, and you simply want the spirit of those rights to be respected. And in order to get around them, Republicans tend to couch their opposition in legal jargon. So you, as a legal scholar, have torn apart their arguments. So why is that critical? How do Republicans use legal jargon, legal arguments to justify racism, sexism, homophobia, etc.?
All right, so let's start from first principles. One, again, one of the reasons why I've written this book is because Republicans seem to be so good at making these kind of heavily legally jargon-laden arguments to the general public. And a lot of people who know conservatives are wrong don't know how to fight them, right? And you shouldn't have to go to law school for 3 years and study this stuff every day in order to fight conservatives' really bad arguments, right? So part of the book is just giving you the arguments that you can make against the conservatives in your life, whether you see them online or at Thanksgiving dinner. Like it's supposed to be, I would hope that this book is useful for people who have to go out in their own personal lives and fight people who are telling them that, you know, rights only exist essentially for white cis hetero males. Beyond that, so that's the start. So in terms of like how they do it, you know, there are lots of ways that I can point it out, but I think one good way is to look at what conservatives say about reproductive rights, right? So they'll tell you, and they're right, that the Constitution does not explicitly defend a woman's right to choose. That's true. There's nothing in the Constitution that says the right to an abortion shall not be abridged by blah, blah, blah. That's all true. You want to know why? You want to know why the Constitution doesn't explicitly protect a woman's right to choose? Because the Constitution did not explicitly protect the woman's right to talk or to own property or to not be raped. There's a lot of things the Constitution doesn't protect when it comes to the issue of women's rights, because the Constitution did not treat women as full people.
Because not women weren't involved, right? Women were just not involved in the writing of the Constitution.
Not only were women not involved in the writing of the original Constitution, they also haven't been involved in the writing of any of the amendments since then, including the amendment that gave women the right to vote. Women were not writing the 19th Amendment, nor did women control any state legislature that had to ratify the 19th Amendment. And women have never held a majority of seats on the Supreme Court, although we might be getting close to that one day. So at no point in American history have a majority, has a body comprised of a majority of women been involved in adjudicating the rights as applied to women, which is kind of weird when you think about it, right? The same goes for the LGBTQ community. The same goes for racial, ethnic, and religious minorities in this country. So again, I come back to this point of, well, if you're going to tell me that this document is legitimate at all, which we can have a whole different debate about, but if you're going to tell me that this document is legitimate at all, then certainly it must evolve. It must breathe. It must live in a world where we understand the rights and responsibilities in this country a little bit more expansively than the exclusively white cis hetero males, men, that have been allowed to adjudicate those rights for most of our history.
Let's talk about the First Amendment. This is a favorite one for conservatives, and it's the one that, as you point out in your book, they tend to misinterpret and misuse to their own end so much. The most recent way in which that has been done is the denouncing of what they call cancel culture. Conservatives love to talk about how liberals and leftists just want to cancel everybody and everything, and sadly, a lot of liberals buy into that as well. What does the First Amendment actually protect? And is cancel culture, as conservatives describe it, a thing?
The First Amendment protects fundamentally political speech. It protects fundamentally the freedom of the press. The people who wrote the First Amendment, they were fundamentally concerned with being able to basically talk smack to the government without catching a bullet, right? Like, that's what they were concerned about. They didn't really, they wanted you to be able to say George Washington is a poopy head without ending up in the brig. Like, that was the goal of the First Amendment. It is not attached to private speech. It's not concerned about private speech. And quite frankly, it would be ridiculous for it to be concerned about private speech. Why should the Constitution take judicial notice of whether a private company cares what you happen to say in the public square? Why would that work, right? So the First Amendment somewhat clearly doesn't deal with private speech, nor should it deal with private speech. And thus, when conservatives claim that they're being canceled, what they're really complaining about is having private people enact consequences because they said something stupid, right? Like, that's really what it boils down to, right? It's not, nobody's canceling J.K. Rowling. I just don't feel like buying the books of an out transphobe. That's all. That's a private decision. Nothing bad's happening to her. I don't want to buy her dumb books now. Okay, that's it. When we talk about Donald Trump being canceled, he's not being canceled. Man was president of the United States, can stomp around Florida free, apparently, despite his many crimes, right? Nobody's canceling him. He got kicked off of a private web platform, Bird app. That's what happened to Donald Trump, which is totally within the purview of that private company to say you can or cannot use our service. That's kind of what they do. Now, if you're talking about the government chilling speech, now that's a whole different problem. When the Department of Justice chills speech, as Bill Barr did when they cleared the square, the Washington of protesters, so Trump could go take a photo op of the Bible, that is an issue of free speech that the founders would care about. That's where the Constitution gets involved. When the government is chilling peaceful protests, that's when the government gets involved, and not before.
I want to talk about police brutality in particular. There's so much to say there, and you've written so much about it in your book. This is also something that conservatives like to couch in legal jargon to justify, to continue justifying the, you know, use of lethal force by police on ordinary people. And I love that you started out one of your chapters in your book, Allow Me to Retort, asking the question, why can't I punch a cop? So take us through that argument, because, you know, it seems as though police are sacrosanct, that even to discuss, you know, the idea of wanting to punch a cop is like talking out loud about killing the president.
Somebody, imagine the situation. I'm sitting in my house, minding my own business, eating some ice cream. Somebody kicks down my door, comes at me with a gun. Why can't I defend myself? Why can't I defend myself? Now, if that's a private citizen doing that, I would have a right to self-defense. In fact, the conservatives, more than anybody, would say that I have a right to pull out a gun and stand my ground and castle doctrine. The conservatives, allegedly, would have my back if I defended myself when somebody kicks down my door, unless it's a cop. If it's a cop, I'm supposed to, what, die? I'm supposed to just genuflect and take it and hope that that cop who is assaulting me, who has broken into my home, does the right thing? How is that reasonable? Well, the only way it's reasonable for me to not basically be able to defend myself against a cop trying to kill me is if we live in a society where the other cops are gonna stop him, right? The rule of law, if it is to mean anything, must mean that the rule of law will apply to those who are being lawless, even under the cover of law. Other cops are, the reason why I can't punch a cop is because other cops are supposed to punch him and stop him from violating my rights or brutalizing me. The fact that we don't have that system, that we don't live in that world, is then the actual problem. Is like that's the problem that we have to fix. And until we get a majority of white people willing to fix it, it's going to continue to be a problem. And I say a majority of white people get angry with me sometimes when I say it that way. The reason why I say a majority of white people want police to be brutal is because whenever we have a vote, whenever we go to the polls, a majority of white people vote for Republicans who then support police brutality, right? The last time a Democrat running for president won the white vote was before the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964. Every presidential election since then, a majority of white folks have voted for the Republican, who has almost universally been a fan of police aggressive policing and brutality. In more recent times, a majority of white people, including a majority of white women, voted for Donald Trump twice. He was only beaten the second time over the objection of a majority of white folks. So that's what's holding us back from where I sit, right? It is that a majority of white people want their police to be brutal. And when given the option to vote for candidates who will stop that, they do not support them.
You point out your book is really meant to be this great handbook for arguments, you know, that lay people can use against legal jargon justifying conservative policies. But in practical terms, it's the Supreme Court that's supposed to, and the Supreme Court justices that interpret our Constitution and our Bill of Rights. And as you were just pointing out, that makes all the difference. And today we have this situation where Democrats are playing defense. We're, you know, not even probably going to have an easy time filling the seat of Stephen Breyer with a black woman, because conservatives already made clear how they feel about that. And even if that were to happen, we would still have a court with 6 conservatives and 3 liberals, maybe 5 conservatives, 1 centrist, and 3 liberals, depending upon your interpretation of this lone centrist on the court. So doesn't the Supreme Court and how it's formed play a big role? Isn't there a very important lay argument to be made for expanding the court, or, you know, what is your take on it in general?
Ah, so you got to the end of my book. Yes. look, I end the whole thing, as you know, with an argument for court expansion, because that's the only thing that will work. It's the only thing that can stop conservatives from having a generational control over American law and policy. People need to understand that there is nothing that I can pass as a Democrat that a 6-3 court cannot strike down. There's nothing to stop them. The third branch of government, the courts, have a veto power over the other two. And until Democrats start understanding that and playing by those rules and fighting for the third branch of government, we will always be behind. But this is where there's a lot of asymmetry involved. And again, one of the reasons why I decided to write this book, because Republicans understand how important the Supreme Court is. Base Republican voters understand how important the Supreme Court is. They might not know all the legal jargon. I'm not saying that Republican voters are smarter than Democratic voters or anything like that, or more civically aware than Democratic voters or anything like that. But they know, because they've been told by their leaders, that if there is something that they want, they must control the Supreme Court to get it, right? So if you're Republican, you might not know what about strict scrutiny and all this kind of substantive due process and all that. But you know that if you don't like gay people having love, well, then you got to get the court. You know that, right? Whereas if you're Democrat, you don't seem to know that if you want anything to happen with climate change, over the next 30 years, then you're going to need liberals on the Supreme Court who will interpret the government, the federal government, of having the authority to bring the fossil fuel industry to heel. You get nothing on climate if you don't control the Supreme Court. You get nothing on voting if you don't control the Supreme Court. You get nothing on guns if you don't control the Supreme Court. Name me an issue you liberal care about, and I will tell you exactly how the Supreme Court will take that away from you if you do not stack it with like-minded liberals. And Democrats generally don't understand that. Republicans do. That is why we lose. That is why we are fighting an uphill asymmetrical battle where Republicans have single issue voters. You can go to a tabernacle in Utah and find some person who's like, well, I don't really like Donald Trump, or but you know, abortion, so I have to vote Republican for the Supreme Court. You can find those people everywhere across the country in Republican pockets. It is very hard to find single issue Democratic Supreme Court voters. And quite frankly, if we had more single issue Democratic Supreme Court voters, Hillary Clinton probably would have won in 2016.
Eli Mestal, thank you so much for joining us today. Best of luck with your book. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Eli Mestal, justice correspondent for The Nation, where he covers the courts, the criminal justice system, and politics. He writes the magazine's monthly column, Objection. He's also an Alfred Nobler Fellow at the Type Media Center. Mestal is a graduate of Harvard College and Harvard Law School. I spoke with him about his book, Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution, for Yes Magazine, where I work as the racial justice editor. You can read a transcript and watch a video of the full interview at yesmagazine.org. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can find out more about this program at risingupwithsonali.com. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.